Thank you. Okay, so indeed, it's actually very good to see a lot of people whose names are up there. Anyway, okay. So let me just begin. So I'm going to propose that actually dense granular materials, so we've looked at rather a dilute system so far, but dense granular materials actually form networks, and that's a way in which you can encode memory. And so the question is, you know, how do we understand a process like that? And so the proposition is that the way to do this is through shearing, and so it's great actually to have Itai sort of pave the way, because a lot of the basic stuff he's talked about, including the Corte paper on suspensions that he mentioned. So we can create memory, we can recreate initial states or come close to, and we can write and rewrite into these granular systems. And to a certain extent, we've gotten hung up on the write and rewrite. How do you actually do that? So I'm going to show you less of training and recall, and more of how you can actually generate states. Okay, so that's the proposition here. And so then really I'm down here. So what are the microscopic processes that lead to a shear jam state, and then how do they come into play in general? Okay. So the context for this is a jamming diagram for frictional grinding materials, and it looks something like this. So there is a range from phi j for frictionless particles down to a lower phi s that depends on the friction coefficient. And in this regime, you can have states which are so-called fragile. They're not, they are, in some sense, they may be lacking enough contacts to be actually jammed. In other cases, they actually have enough contacts, but they're highly anisotropic. And finally, with enough shear stress, tau, you end up in a shear jam state. So that's the background for this. And so that one point is that as we shear our system, we can drive it back and forth through a range of shear stresses that correspond to unjammed, to highly anisotropic fragile states, to shear jammed. Okay. So that's the idea. We have these different states. We won't go near the yield surface of the system. So that's something for a different talk. And so then the question is, how do we understand the origin of these networks? And in fact, what distinguishes networks? So you have different networks depending on the protocol that you actually carry out. Okay. So here are picture. This is a picture, if you like, a rather old picture. At this point, of what happens if you shear a quasi-2D granular system, and so this is an inner boundary of the system. The particles are contained within an outer boundary out here, and for some reason that's rotated. Okay, so maybe rotation is in vogue right now. Okay, so when you shear the system, you develop a force network where the bright here red particles are actually ones carrying the largest forces, and the blue particles are ones where in fact you have very minimal force. And so just so you can play with this, okay, so there is I have a demo. Let me ask you, don't take it apart. I mean, this is, however intriguing this is. So there are two modes of operation here. You can squeeze it, or you can shear it. And these are photoelastic particles, so like this. But to make this work, you have to hold it up to the light. Okay, so that's the two words of wisdom is two different strain protocols. Okay, and then if you don't hold it up to the light, you won't see anything. Okay, so, all right, good. So this is the kind of system I'm thinking of. And in spite of the fact that this picture is specific to a coet shear, if you go looking in other quasi-2D systems, it's pervasive, right? So these are examples in this case, what happens after a clog in a hopper flow. This is what happens if you pour particles into a heap. This is actually a point force measurement, so a kind of Green's force measurement. These are the hands of Zhe Zhang, and you can actually get these, have a pure shear experiment, which looks something like that. Okay. So just a comment, okay, so our particles are in this case, all going to be disks. That's not the only kind we look at, but for the moment, that's what we're going to consider. And these are granular particles. I mean, they're in some sense real grains. They only interact when they're touching, Okay, so if the particles aren't touching, there's no force. They are decidedly elastic particles, so if you push them together, there's a restoring force that pushes them apart, and the nature of that force depends on the nature of the particles. So for spheres or even fairly thin disks, the forces are actually Hertzian. So the pushing apart is with a power of the so-called overlap that's 3/2, close to 3/2. The other thing is that these are representative of frictional particles. They have friction. And that's why the jamming diagram looks the way it does. Friction is important. The other important piece is that if you have frictional particles, you no longer have a conserved energy that you can use. So you can't use the usual Hamiltonian trick or the energy minimization trick as a way of generating states. In general, if you prepare a system, it will not be in the lowest possible energy state. Anyway, it's most definitely athermal, right? These are big particles. So rather different in that sense from the things that we saw from Itai. Okay, so a comment. If you compress particles, and again, you can recreate these states for yourself. Just take the little demo and try compressing or shearing. Okay, and you can generate either something close to an isotropic state, which is, in this case, a rather dense tangle of force networks, or in this case, a sheared system. Okay, so then what you're doing, in fact, with that demo, is you're looking through cross-polarizers at a material that is birefringent under stress or strain. Okay, that's what is called photoelastic. And what the system does, these are polymers typically, is that when you apply typically shear strain within the material, you have preferred or different speeds of light through the material depending on the principal directions. And when you look through cross polarizers, you're sensitive to that. So that's the crash course on that. This is actually, if you just pick one particle up, they're quite sensitive. And this actually is the hand of Joshua Dykesman. And he's just shooting this with his cell phone. So it turns dark when he squeezes because cell phones adjust the, right? Okay, good, all right. So then the idea is you want to use this photoelastic response as a quantitative tool. We didn't invent using photoelastic particles to look at granular materials. That was done actually by a Japanese person before World War II, I think. And then by a French guy in the 60s, a guy named Dantu. And if they had had all sorts of fancy image processing, maybe they would have solved this particular problem. But we want to be able to measure quantitatively what forces are acting on the particle, and so we do it two ways. One is you say, okay, I squeeze on the particle. This is a real particle with white light. And when you do that, you get a set of dense fringes, and those fringes become denser as you squeeze harder. So the idea is to come up with a calibration that is representative of that fringe number. How many fringes do you have? Okay. So if you compute a gradient in the image, okay, so standard sort of thing, and then you square it to get a magnitude and sum it over a particle, you can calibrate that quite precisely against the applied pressure acting on that particle. Okay, so good. That's one way to do it. And that's quick and dirty and highly efficient computationally. So I can give you a picture, and if you want to know the pressure acting on at a particle scale, okay, so more properly the trace of the force moment tensor, you're off and running and you have that. On the other hand, you might want to really use this in a more powerful way to get the contact forces. And so the contact forces actually determine the photoelastic pattern in a straightforward way. So the trick is that if I actually know the contact forces and where they act, so here are three forces acting on this disk, three more or less identical forces in terms of magnitude, then you get a specific pattern, okay, which is set by the fact that those forces determine through the biharmonic equation what the stresses are inside that particle. And if I know the stresses in the plane of this disk, then I can get the transmitted intensity. So the logic is straightforward. That's the forward direction. You give me the forces, I give you the photoelastic pattern. And so what we do is by a nonlinear process, fitting process, we turn that around. So first you have to find the particles, of course, and where the forces act. That's relatively straightforward. And then we have to do a nonlinear fitting form with the forces, vector forces, the fit parameters, to the transmitted intensity over the plane of a disk. So we're off and running. And of course, we know these are force and torque balanced, so we can do things a little bit more efficiently that way. And we have the third law, so the force we determine from particle A acting on particle B must match, but be opposite sign to the other way around. Okay. So we start with an image like this. Okay, it's taken with a large format digital camera, and these are of course pretty affordable these days. The response, if you look back, depends on the wavelength of the light as well as the shear stress in the material. So you have to filter, because otherwise you get beautiful colored patterns that are hard to interpret. So you filter, and then you fit, and so that's the fitted image. So the chain is original image filtered, and then this is what we determine by the fit. All right, so once you have that, you're off and running, because you have information in an experiment which is generally inaccessible, right? That's the trick. So, right, so there's no other way that I know of to go in with a grinding material and get quite so precise measurements of the force. These are two-dimensional, right? So you can do something in three dimensions, and I'm not going to talk about that now, but you can measure forces, but it's a little bit harder. So now you have the ability to compute things like stresses and fabrics, which are fairly standard items. Something like the fabric has a trace, which is the contact number, and it also gives you some measure of the structure in your system. You get a stress. Go away. Don't go away. So in principle, right, if these were frictionless particles, if I knew the fabric tensor, then I would, in a straightforward way, I could tell you, and I know the locations of all the particles, I could tell you the stress tensor. Because I have friction with tangential forces, the story is more complicated. Okay. Right. So then, of course, you want to be able to track these particles, and you'd also like to know whether they're rotating or not. And again, if they were frictionless, rotation is out of the picture. These particles rotate like crazy oftentimes, and that's distinctly part of the picture.
Sorry,
yes?
Explain what fabric is?
Yep. Okay. So it's a good question. Okay. So basically what it is if I have a particle here and a contact, so there's another particle, and I take the unit vectors from, say, this particle to that one. Okay, and then I take the dyadic product of that, okay, and so then either at the particle scale or summed over my whole system and all contacts, I get this global fabric. Okay, so it is basically telling me about the contact network. In a contact network, it's a tensorial measure of the contact network. So for instance, a different way to think about this is if I have an isotropic system, then I would expect that I would get the eigenvectors of this fabric tensor would be identical. But if I have anisotropy in my system, then I'm going to get, if there's one principal direction, I will get one bigger and two smaller eigenvalues, right? So that's another way to think about it. And ditto, by the way, so if I look at the stress tensor or the force moment tensor, which are sort of differ by a factor of the area or the volume in 3D, then if I have an isotropic system, I just have a pressure, all the eigenvalues are the same. When we shear it, then decidedly you have anisotropic stresses as well. Okay, that shows up as differences in the eigenvectors of the stress tensor. Okay, good. Okay. So we're tracking rotation and position of these things, and so if we have three different kinds of particles at the moment, one where we've coated them with Teflon, so they're kind of slippery, one where they're as made, and so we have various ways of making these, and another which are very frictional and they have very rough gear-shaped edges. So they actually interlock, and so in some sense this is it's hard to say how big the friction coefficient is, but it's much bigger than one, right? So once they're interlocked, you can apply arbitrary amounts of tangential force on those particles, between those particles, right? And then, so, we're imaging them in multiple ways. Okay. Make sure they are. Okay, so, and I should add, okay, so for present purposes, by the way, I want to really only focus on particles with a friction coefficient of a little bit more than a half. Okay, that's going to be where we have most of our data and where I'm focusing for today. Okay. All right, so another piece of context, and I think many of the people are aware of this, but there were, if you like, two theoretical propositions 20 years ago, I guess, at this point. One was a picture which was particularly applicable to a sheared, in this case, colloidal system, and the idea was that you could shear the system and develop a force network, and that it more strongly resisted shear in the original shear direction than in the reverse. Okay, so that's by Cates et al. And then the Liu-Nagel proposition, which was later investigated extensively and borne out by studies by Ahern et al. For frictionless spheres. Okay, so, all right. So I want to focus on shear, and so just so we share the same vocabulary, I'm going to do pure shear, which is one where I compress and dilate but keep the area constant. Or I'll also do simple shear, which actually turns out to be a good way to do business in this system for technical reasons. And then, of course, couette shear. This is something where, you know, the big blue eye is a couette experiment, but for here, I don't need to talk about it. Okay. All right, so this is, let me just sort of back up. So what I want to show you is what happens when I shear one of these granular systems. And this is this is pure shear. And this was, at this point, a relatively early attempt to see what happens when you shear granular materials. And it started from a stress-free state. Okay, so this is at the bottom of that shear jamming diagram where you have stress-free in between phi s and phi j. And so the area of the system isn't changing even though I want to look at this a couple times. So the area never changes. We reverse the shear. Okay, and so it happily develops a force network in the reverse sense. And it becomes actually quite stiff. And then finally, we'll go back home. So we never change the area of the system. And we'll start and end with the same boundaries. Okay. So let me play that again. Okay. So start from zero force, zero stress, compressing vertically, expanding horizontally. Okay. Reverse shear and it melts. Okay. So it melts almost entirely away. And then, it's order of 15%, so maximum strain of roughly 15%. And then maybe 20. Of that order, it's not huge. And then you go back home, okay, and okay, voila. Okay, so in some sense, this seems like the anti-memory, right? I mean, we did a cycle and we came up with something quite different. But I'll show you actually. Depending on how you do it, you can create states that do remember where they started. But in this case, we started unjammed and ended up strongly jammed, but anisotropic. Okay. Okay. So then the data for this is in say this picture, where we actually have a plot. So this is data that Jay Zhang painfully took. So many many different experiments here in some sense. And the black here states which are basically totally unjammed. There's no percolating force network anywhere. The red corresponds to states which are fragile. You can get a percolating network, but only in one direction, a strong network in one direction. And then you end up in a green zone where you can, if you reverse the strain, the system won't melt away. But if you're down here and you reverse the strain, then the system tends to melt. Okay, and so The way in which we actually tried to characterize that was by looking at a K-core percolation analysis of the force networks that you get in the just the compressive direction, and then in the then looking at the overall network of the whole system, and whether you got a strong network that percolated everywhere. Okay, so that's one piece. And so then the idea is, as a sketch, you have something like this, where in this region you have fragile or totally unjammed states, and here you can get to a state which is not necessarily reversible, but doesn't melt if you reverse the strain. Okay, so a couple quick things. If you look at the shear stress or pressure from the system versus phi, you get this cloud of points. This is the same set of points that you saw before. But if you now plot those data as a function of the non-Rattler fraction, so these are particles that are mechanically stable, so how many of them are there out of the total, then all that data collapses onto a common curve. And in a similar fashion, if you look at the contact number per particle, average of the system, for all those different data, then plotted versus F and R, you get a collapse. And there's a well-defined point here where the nature of that curve changes, and so then this gives some measure of where we think that the system jams. Okay. All right. So then you can say, well, you know, how does this depend on the density? And for this system, it looks something like this. So this is how much shear strain you need to jam it. And so as you drop from frictionless isotropic jamming down to lower and lower packing fractions, then this tells you how much strain you need. And actually, when we take particles for a system where we can shear it further, the actual lowest value is somewhere down here. Okay. All right. Well, all right. Well, hello. All right. How weird. All right. Good. All right. Good. Have to think about that one. So there's a basic issue with this experiment, and it's one that actually led us to a simple shear experiment, which is also one where you can think or ask questions about memory. And the problem with this system is that it shear bends. So if you look at the density in the along a diagonal in that system after it's been sheared, or various components of the strain tensor, you can see that there's shear bands in it. Okay, so not an ideal system to look at this. So we want a system that doesn't shear band, and so this is it for the moment anyway. And so in this case, the particles sit on a base which deforms affinely with the walls. Okay, so So the particles sit there, there's a little weak friction between them, between the particles and the base. When we displace the walls, okay, these slats move along, okay? So schematic, something like that. And so you never leave particles behind, and those are actually the holes that you leave behind are the genesis for shear bands. So we want to avoid that. Okay. Well, that's interesting. Okay. So the upshot is, well, you get images that sort of look like, yeah, so this is good. So these are displacements along, these are displacements of particles along the shear strain direction, and so they actually line up very well, and in the transverse to the shear direction, particles fluctuate but don't move, and so you maintain a rather homogeneous density, okay? So now you have a system in which you can try to ask questions about something with a well-defined density. Okay, so this is what it is, okay? Okay, so you can maybe see a little better where the boundary is on this one, right? Okay, so decidedly this shear jams, starting from zero, and you get the characteristic networks that I mentioned earlier. Come on. So you go from basically no force-carrying particles to a force network in the compression direction, and then eventually everywhere. All right. And so, just a quick reminder: that's what the high friction particles look like. And so just again to give you a flavor, if I shear particles of different friction coefficient, even rather slippery ones will reach a shear jam state. But the larger the friction, the stronger the effect. Or if you like, the lower the phi, I can go and still shear jam. Okay. All right, so now what happens if I do cyclic shear on these? and ask, do these systems have a memory? What do they do? And so we're going to do various kinds of shear and reverse protocols on this. These are all static states, right? So none of these are dynamic. Okay, we shear a little bit, we wait. Okay, the system can relax out the kazoo in principle, and it doesn't change once we shear. Okay, so one protocol, which is an asymmetric one, is one where we shear one direction to come back, etc. Okay, and that's going to be the more interesting one here. Okay, but if you shear back out to say a few percent and then reverse in the opposite direction, you very quickly find a limit cycle, or an absorbing state where the pressure goes back and forth, it has a dip, and the actual shear stress actually has this nice clean hysteresis loop, and the system gets to that state very quickly. But if you actually go one way and come back to zero, then the system actually goes back close to where it was. So it remembers where it was, pretty much, not quite. But you go out, come back, and it comes back with almost the same configuration. But if you keep doing it over and over again, you'll find the same absorbing state. Okay. So this, I think I have to hit. So let's just look at that. This is a system where we looked at 100 cycles. And so you can sort of see at first, system goes out, comes back almost to where it was, not quite. But every time it evolves slightly, and so it's gradually looking for this absorbing state. And so then if you look at the last 5 cycles or so, okay? Right, so it's, if you notice, okay, so this is this G squared measure, it's a measure of the system pressure, and so the system comes back almost along the same path, okay, but it doesn't look like quite the same path, and that's not experimental noise, okay? The experimental noise here is much lower than that. And so let's just look at what the particles do, okay? So that's what the particles look like, okay? And so this is strobed, so every time you come back to zero strain, it looks like, oh, hello, okay. So let's go back. Right. So you have to look fast. So the particles are jiggling around, but they're not moving very far. They basically come back home, but they're rotating a lot. Okay, that might suggest something to you, right? So why would they rotate? Okay, all right. So that's a slightly rhetorical question. But if you look at what the force network is doing for those same particles, when they return, in fact, the main force network stays there, but the smaller parts of the force network are strongly, strongly fluctuating, right? So this system comes back in terms of position, but it's not coming back in terms of stresses. It's fluctuating a fair amount, okay? So then the question is, okay, so, you know, yeah. Yep.
Why isn't it?
Well, so you're getting fluctuations, okay? How small they are is a different question, right? Because there's a lot of it going on. So it's, you know, the total stress in that system is determined by all of that network, and not just how strong a small piece of it is. So it's decidedly fluctuating, right? Okay, it's not coming back to the same network, and, you know, I'm not sure, we never actually can find, so we, you know, if we go like a percent strain, okay, this still happens, right? So the system is not, system goes back, and so you know, just go look at this, right?
Yeah. A different interpretation that the main structure of the force network remains the same.
Right.
And
but
you're getting small fluctuations on top of it.
Yeah, that's correct. That's what you're seeing. Right. Okay. Right. So the system is returning in space. Okay. And that's why you see the big structure hanging around. But it's not maintaining. It's rotating. So as soon as you rotate, you're breaking the force network. Okay. And so then that's why that's is associated with the fluctuations you see in the network too. Okay, so what? How can we think about it? How can we characterize this process? And so, if you think back to the, you know, that composite video, the first five and the last five of 100 cycles, you saw that when you went to the maximum strain, you had some large pressure. You came back and you had some actually rather small pressure. But if you keep looking at the pressure at the maximum forward and the return strains, those two sets of data converge, and in fact, after a while, they lock onto each other. So the system is doing a really rather odd set of fluctuations, but it's not evolved, so the difference in those pressures isn't evolving anymore, and that happens at a reasonably well-defined, So a reasonably defined value of the cycle number is where they come back together. And so now if you plot, so if you take the original data for delta P for a bunch of different densities, right, so here are the densities, and divide the N here by the number it takes to close that pressure gap, then what you discover is that all densities for a given strain collapse, okay? Right, so this is just the way that the data turn out. And so then that suggests, in fact, that if you then took the delta P, plotted as log of N over that N0, and multiplied it by a strain-dependent amplitude, everybody would look the same, okay? And in fact, that's right. And so then if you plot that amplitude that you need to collapse the data, then to some crude approximation, you can decide how crude, that is a straight line in the strain amplitude. So the strain amplitude is what is providing a kind of excitation in the system, and you get something like an activated relaxation where you can think of this as a kind of time, so the normalized number of steps to relax your system scales as the delta P over whatever you think beta is, some activation parameter. Okay, so that's good. And so then, and that's life. I mean, that's what the system does. And now the question is, we got actually diverted less by whether you could train the system or do that sort of thing as to what on earth is, what's going on? How does the system know to do this, right? So the whole shear jamming process is in some sense deterministic, right? I give you a set of particles and I shear it, and the system will develop a particular set of stresses, a particular set of stress networks. So what's making it do that? Okay, in fact, I can reverse it and I get back almost to the same state. So this is close to reversible, but not quite, right? Okay, so how do the grains know to do this, right? They seem to be smarter than we are. Okay, so they know what to do. So this is an exploration to try to understand how that could happen. Okay. So the first thing is to look at just where are the grains going during a certain amount of shear. This is 20% shear, and you track the particles. And it looks pretty affine, right? So particles at the boundary are being carried faster than those in the center, and if you subtract the affine shear strain from all those displacements, you find that the particles are making very, very small non-affine fluctuations, right? So they're just not going very far, right? So it's not like particles are going all over the place. They're stay-at-home bodies. So now what? Well, here's some other sort of comments. So, we see force chains, and they sort of, we think they're straight, okay? Well, first of all, force chains are not straight, okay? They can't be straight, right? So if you take, if you take three particles, and you think they're elements of a force chain, and these, I'll keep coming back to three particles, so I'll give this a name, a trimer. So if I have three particles, and they're arranged like this, I can have contact forces between them with no other particles coming into play as long as the bending angle here is less than the tangent of that, is less than the friction coefficient. Okay, that's good. Okay, so I can make force chains that are three particles long. Okay, not very interesting per se, right? Okay, and now I want to say, okay, well, what happens if I want to make them four particles long? What do I do? So I put a particle down here. It has to be exactly there to keep everybody in force and torque balance. This is, you know, this is a freshman physics calculation. If you want to upset your freshman, give them this calculation. Give it home at test, even better. Okay, all right, no, I would never do that. Okay, so something else, no way, okay? There's no way you're going to get force chains that are self-sustaining, okay? They don't happen that way, so, all right. So, right, in addition, right, force, I mean, sort of a, if you like, a coda to this is to say, look, the isostatic packing contact number for frictional particles has to be at least 3. Okay, force chain particles, if you took them in isolation, every particle would have 2 contacts. So force chains by themselves can't stand alone. Okay, they've got neighbors that are doing stuff, right? The other thing that isn't at play here is you don't have things like T1 events, right? Particles don't move that much, okay? So we can rule out that. And by the way, T1 events relax stress, and we're trying to find ways to create stress, right? So that's, it's got to be something else, okay? So in addition, if you look, okay, chains, go away, okay. So chains wiggle and they form, they branch, right? Okay, so you never actually get force chains you rarely get force chains that span a system. Okay, so that's the shear process, and you look at that and you're not going to see too much. But now this is, if I look at a close-up, let's go back if we can. So look at the photoelastic image to the right. All right, there we go. Okay. Look at the 2 blue particles. So, okay, we'll come back and look at this a little bit later. Well, what's happening is that trimer, those 3 blue particles, are being pushed together because they're sort of aligned in the compression direction. That actually makes them bend. Okay. That's what they're doing. They're bending a little bit. And so maybe we'll go back and look one more time. Okay, so watch the uppermost particle here. Come on, not fast enough. That one. He comes down and starts to squeeze those guys. They bend. They push on a guy in the dilation direction. And you can do a freshman high school geometry calculation, which shows that if I'm pushing those 2 blue outer particles together, the inner one gets pushed in the dilation direction faster than the dilation. Okay, so you have a mechanism to actually create a network in the transverse direction. Okay. Hello. All right. Okay. Good. Okay. So what we want to do, among other things, is we want to look at small-scale configurational changes. You know, what happens to particles that could become part of a force chain, perhaps, among other things. And so you have zillions, of course, of potential particles that are 1, 2, 3 particles in contact like that. Right. All right, so of course not all of those are important. We're going to look at a set which could be aligned in the force, the compression direction of the strain, and see what they do. Okay, so we're going to characterize these trimers of interest by how much they bend. Okay, so force chains definitely bend. And then if you look at the line of contacts here, that's inclined relative to the compression direction by alpha. So that's sort of the relevant parameters. Okay, and so now, if you're more or less, the contact line is more or less in the compression direction, compression pushes the outer 2 particles together against the middle one, okay, and then that will bend the trimer, it will push the center particle out efficiently, and so then you can create extra contacts, and that's what you need, right? You need to get Z up to at least 3, so that's the game, okay. All right, so now we're going to do this in slow-mo, hopefully, okay, so. Famous last words is a slow-mo. So watch this guy come in, collides with that, all of a sudden, boom, he lights up. Okay, so you've seen, you're going to hate this video before long, but okay. And then that bends and it creates the extra contact. So this is going on all the time in this system, but it's a little bit hard to see without going back and painfully identifying all these things. So here's the pressure on the center particle. It's 0 to start with. When the first 2 particles, the outside particles, collide with that middle particle, the pressure starts to rise. And then after this theta bends a lot, all of a sudden I form a contact in the dilation direction and the pressure zooms up. Okay, so that's what the system is doing, but it's doing that in some statistical way all over the system. Okay, well, hello. All right, so just to sort of track this a little bit, here is, during this process of sheer jamming, I start at a contact number Z, that's the red scale. It's down well below what I need to get jammed, and Z is growing. The number of particles, or the fraction of particles, that have two contacts start out rather high. That's just sort of random contacts initially. As I shear my system, I lose those contacts by, say, this bending and other processes. The number of particles that have three contacts grows, essentially, right? All right, so that's sort of the scheme of what's going on. And now we want to have a global measure of that. Okay, so here's a proposal for a global measure. I want to, for every trimer that I'm of interest, for instance, or every trimer in principle, I can define one measure which tells me how straight the trimer is. Okay, so I just use the unit vectors for the two outer particles relative to the center. Okay, so this geometric combination, this geometric combination is 1 if the trimer is straight, and it's 0 if it's maximally bent. Okay, I can only bend the trimer so far, it runs into itself. And this tells me how well aligned I am in the compression direction. So if alpha is 0, the line of forces in that trimer is exactly along the compression direction, and if so when alpha goes to pi over 2, okay, then those are trimers which are in the dilation direction, and so in that case, they have a minus 1, okay? And we can normalize this, okay, so if I throw a bunch of particles into a container, I expect that my trimers will sort of have random orientations, but if I just assume that in terms of straightness, they're uniformly distributed, and this angle, they're also uniformly distributed, then if I look only over the range of this quantity where it's positive, then I have a way of normalizing that. That's the normalization we use. And so now what happens, So if you look at this quantity for the trimers that actually form the force network at jamming, this quantity starts at a value initially, and this is for typical phi, okay? So it starts at a value which is order of 40% of the maximum I might expect for a random distribution, and then it stops. Okay, so this small fingers. So then it gradually decreases as I reach jamming. Jamming actually occurs here. If I now plot for many different phis, what that initial average O is for the trimers that become the force network at jamming. It starts out here at a very high value. Okay, 1 is the max, what you would expect for the max. And in all cases, when I get to shear jamming, I get to a value which is somewhere between 0.2 and 3. Okay, so the system collectively is doing this bending process that creates 3 and more contacts. That's what it's doing. And so if you actually look at the pressure that is generated by all trimers all trimers go greater than 0 here, okay, then that constitutes roughly somewhere between 70 and 80% of all the pressure in the system until I'm well past jamming. Okay, so presumably this is the process, right, that's going on here. So what I hoped you've seen is that I can create a set of strong networks, that these networks are actually written in some way that's really quite deterministic, but in a way that isn't captured by a lot of the usual tricks that we have, right? So we have to have a mechanism that creates force networks, and what we typically have is ways which relax stress. So we're on a different part of a strain curve. So we're building up stress, and we're doing that by small conformational changes, right? Only small, because this system is not going anywhere, okay? Particles don't go very far, okay? But they can change their orientations, and that's a mechanism that will both change the mean contact number, okay? And also allow you to, get you to a shear jam state. It's also has to be the same mechanism that's at play when you reverse the shear, right? So what I've focused on mostly towards the end here is what happens when you're shear jamming it, right? But when you reverse it, okay, then you have to do something where you're now actually acting on trimers who are rotated by 90 degrees relative to the first set. Okay, so I haven't told you anything about the reverse process, right? So that's, I would say, a work in progress, but I would say I think I understand what's going on when you do the first writing into the system. Okay, great, thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
Could you go back to the picture where you're showing, you know, the kind of like a vector field from where you subtracted the affine motion? This was kind of...
Yep, yeah, I think I can. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So you know, when I look at this figure C, I'm not seeing, of course, a lot of vorticity, right? I mean, this is like you have.
Yeah,
if you were
some.
To calculate the work, does you know you have sort of these you know you have these you know circular vector fields. So this,
yep.
You know, that I would have thought that this would correlate to these events that you've been showing. You know, that you were doing at the trimers. You know, is this anyway? You know, with the contact number changing, is this flow? You know. Related to it, I mean, for example, if you showed that movie where you had the three blue circles mm-hmm. with the red one, mm-hmm. and you subtracted the affine motion away from it, would you be able to correlate some of the features in this figure to the events that's happening there? Maybe it's a more coarse-grained description of what's happening.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, most definitely you do have vortex structure in the non-affine motion. But you know,
would it be meaningful information to analyze what's happening in this?
Could be. I mean, okay. I don't, you know, I can't give you a definitive answer, but I think that's an interesting thing to think about. Okay.
So I guess I'm still trying to make analogies,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and so I'll just throw it out there and then see what you have to say. But
got it. I would love people to be choked out. But, okay.
So the basic analogy is that the the big force chains mm. are staying static.
Well. They don't go away. It doesn't mean that they're static.
Right. Sorry.
It doesn't go away.
Right. So during the shear oscillation cycle, once you get into a reversible state, they somehow maintain some overall backbone to mm-hmm. the forces.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the you know the small you know jumps that you get are from the small force
right.
chains that are breaking and reforming.
Right. Yeah.
And so, in some sense, you know. Again, it's kind of like what sets the loop for, or what sets the criteria for being able to deform a loop of stress
mm-hmm.
in a way that's reversible, and that's kind of where that
right.
seems to tie back to
yep.
the way
right.
I'm thinking about the gels.
Well, so the question is, yeah. So do you want to think of this as a loop, okay? And So my picture is a little different, I would say, and that is I worry less about how much the system loops around because of friction, right? So you have no friction in your system, right? I don't think, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So I think that the stability criteria are different. I think that's actually probably important here, also my system is quite a bit more dense. Right, so if you're at 30%,
the question is, what do you need in order to sustain a force, you know,
right.
chain,
yep.
and make it reversible,
yep.
and somewhere it has to preserve the forces while still being able to strain.
Well, don't forget, it doesn't literally preserve the forces. It comes back to the same forces, so it melts in between.
So that's the question. Does it completely melt in between?
Well,
after a while, not.
After a while, not. But it's a different set of force chains in between, right? So you're compressing this way, and so it's not. So of course it's not clear that it's the same set of force chains coming back, after a while, right? So in other words, when you go through the dip, you're also equally compressed coming back. So.
Right, so that's the question. Is it the main chain that's still maintained throughout the process, or is it completely disorganizing?
Yeah, right, so nothing completely disorganizes is part of the trick, right? The particles just come back almost to where they were. So that is, right? So that doesn't change.
No, just during, I don't want to dominate everything, but the idea is that during the strain oscillation, is that primary force chain maintaining it some sort of integrity, or is it completely disorganizing and then it happens to come back?
I don't want to claim exactly, but I mean, if I did that experiment with forward and reverse shear, then for sure that force chain would go away. Right? So if I shear to 5%, shear back to -5%, I have a totally different network in the -5%.
Maybe not once it's trained, I guess.
No. I mean, so the -5%, of course, will be trained, but it's not the same as the +5%. I think that's guaranteed. Okay.
Yeah. So I just had kind of a comment on your trimers.
Yeah.
One thing that it reminded me of is actually jet formation. If you have essentially inertial confinement pushing together, you can get a jet flowing up.
Right.
Which would imply that there's actually a best angle that's going to push that center particle out the fastest. So, you know, if they're too much at 90 degrees,
yeah.
It's not going to work. They're too.
Yeah, so zero, turns out zero is the best.
Yeah, so you could actually have sort of like, they're like super slow jets.
Yeah.
But it could be interesting to think about it in that term.
We have thought a bit about that. Talk too much about it, but if you actually compute how fast that center particle comes out for a differential compression this way, the rate of displacement horizontally goes as cotan square of theta. So actually, is you get zero mechanical advantage when you push out when theta is very small, okay? But the rate at which you push out is actually diverges theoretically at zero. So there is an optimum angle, it just doesn't do much. I mean, so you have to have some bend because otherwise it won't continue. Yeah.
So one thing I wasn't quite clear is you've used the word reversible and so forth, but is it reversible or just repeat or periodic? That is, when you undo the constraint, I mean, you eventually get to the same point and you get into a loop, but are you going... when you returning your stress, your strain, are you going back the same way you came out, or are you going through kind of a loop?
So it depends on what property you measure, but if you look as a system, it's definitely not. So it has a hysteresis loop. So you don't literally follow back, but you come back to a state where you're almost back home, but not quite. So in between, you're doing something quite different. And so in that sense, I would say it's probably different from a suspension case where you think that the particles are sort of following, it's sort of like the Taylor example where you reverse the system and you completely reverse the trajectory. So here, you have a trajectory which is different in some sense. And I think that's simply because you have these anisotropic stresses. You actually have a stress and contact network that you formed, and that, once you form that, you have to undo it. And when you then coming back, you've got a new contact network. So I think the answer is it's not, it has structure that doesn't go away. You build in anisotropy that survives.
So if you looked at stroboscopically at those final states, they are not unlike what Itai was showing us. They don't look the same.
Well,
each time.
They don't. Well, right. They don't. Although, if you only look at the positions, I don't think they look
that
different.
The force chains don't.
But the force chains decidedly don't.
Don't.
I mean, I think that's the interesting feature, right?
Well,
that difference.
They change, like the small force chains change, but the big ones, you said.
Well, so I think if we wanted to make a fair comparison, you'd have to look at differentially. So what I'm showing you is the direct image, at every return point. And so if you were to ask me what are the strong force chains doing, My answer would be, I don't know unless I look differentially. So I'd have to subtract images to answer that question. And so just because they're still at the same spot doesn't mean they have the same strength.
Right. Yeah. I think that's an important thing to distinguish.
Bob, if you put in disks of all different sizes and stuff like that, is that going to do anything to this?
I think the answer is how different is all different.
You and tell me.
So if you packed it, so, you know, if I tried to do an Apollonian packing, that would be the extreme where it will clearly be different, right? So these are by disperse because we don't want it to order. So we want to have a disordered system. How disordered I can make it, how polydispersed I can make it, I don't know before. I probably would eventually break this, but I don't know. I don't know where. And at the other extreme, if I put in monodispersed particles, I think it will look somewhat different. But I mean, if you take, you know, Karen's experiments from, you know, a while ago, where she actually showed that you order spheres by shaking and you disorder them by shearing, and so that was an experiment with monodispersed spheres where the shearing process actually broke up any crystalline order. So I'm guessing you'd probably be all right as you go toward monodispersed, but you would surely fail as you got really, really polydispersed.
Hey, is the initial configuration important or interesting at all? It looked like you started out in a relatively zero-ish stress state, which
you start from very close to.
Is that hard to get to?
Well, it depends on where you are in density. So the closer you get to the isotropic frictionless jamming point, the harder it is. Because basically, so if you think about it, right, the difference between a frictional and frictionless set of particles is just what the tangential forces are. So if I can relax all the tangential forces, then I ought to be able to get very close to 0.84 in two dimensions, which we can do, but it takes more and more tapping to relax those stresses. So you can. When you get down to the low end of things, then it's actually very easy to generate a zero stress state. But the system does have memory of what it was, how it was put together. So, you know, if you put in some funky correlation in the way you place particles, then that hangs around for a long while. So the idea is to make it as isotropic, you know, stress-free as possible. But that's an approximation.
Okay, cool. And that's just you tap it a bunch and then
you tap it a bit and it relaxes.
All right, thanks.
Magic putting in a particle.
Yeah, putting in one particle at a time, I think, is what you mean. Yes. Yeah. Okay.
All right. Other questions? All right. Let's thank Bob.